So, hi and welcome to the 4T cast.
Bloopers.
Oh my god. Hi and welcome to the 4T podcast. I'm Brian.
And I'm Austin.
And we're here talking about farming.
Woo! Yeehaw!
All right. So, just to give you a little background about both of us here when it comes to farming, both of us have done farming here in Japan itself. So, Austin can start with his.
Yeah, for me, farming started when I came to Japan. I have not really done any farming before. I've worked on a ranch with cows and horses and, you know, taking care of the stables. But other than that, I've never done any farming, as in planting rices, planting crops.
Austin was talking about shoveling poop.
So the extent of my farming goes through subsistence farming, vegetables to grow and eat for my family, and growing rice. That's about the extent of my farming background. Yeah. How about you?
Well, my family has had a farm since I was born.
Oh, okay.
Now, we did live in town, but we had a farmstead outside of town that we used to go and work the land there. Now, I've been riding on the tractor itself since I've been about like 3 or 4. But this was when I lived in southern Minnesota, but we moved to northern Minnesota. And when we moved to northern Minnesota and I was about 10, I learned how to drive the tractor, skid loader. We had dairy cows, so we milked cows. We also had 210 acres of land, in which we had to, you know, plow, till, had alfalfa. We grew, barley. We grew oats. We grew, think Milo, corn, soybeans. So for me, I've had a lot of experience with farming. I even learned how to ride and saddle a horse at age of 10.
See, he just has a little bit of experience, not much more than me.
I would consider myself and my father cowboys, because we still wear like cowboy brand jeans. Like, I have Wranglers. I'm wearing Cinch right now. I mean, I have Tony Lamas. I got 2 pairs of Tony Lamas downstairs that I have, and a pair of Lou Casey's for those of you that are, country boot nuts. I also have a Stetson hat, which is my Sunday hat, because I don't really wear it anywhere except for out when it's a special event and it's a 10X. So anyway, we're going to be talking about farming here in Japan. Now, both of us have had experience here in Japan farming. For me, the first time I ever got to do it was a co-worker of my wife invited me and another friend to go out there and do some planting. And we actually got to drive the planter.
Oh, really?
Which is very interesting. Very cool. And then also my wife's relatives that live up in Akita, they have a small farm up there as well. They have about 10 plots, or 10 rice paddies, if you want to call them that, or 10 paddies up there that they plant rice, and I try to go up there every year. This year I couldn't go because my son was born in May.
Congratulations.
Yes. As a matter of fact, he was born on May 4th.
Woo!
Star Wars Day. And because the planting season for them starts around in between the 20th, like around the 20th, I wasn't able to go because I just had a newborn. So, anyway, well, let's talk about like the how the season starts.
Okay.
So with the seedlings that they get before they actually go and plant them out in the field.
Okay. So first thing that happens, at least the way that my father-in-law always does it, is we have a giant blue vat that's filled with water, and you get your rice seeds and put them in blue net bags and soak them for, I think, about a month.
Yep.
And it's for over the past couple of years, it's actually been fairly cold. So what we would do is 2 weeks before we plant them, we would put them in a different vat and heat the water.
Yes.
For probably another week or so.
Yep.
Until just the roots are starting to show.
Right.
Barely starting to show.
And then after that, you put them in the square flats.
Yes.
So they're the square flats that they use in Japan. Now, in inches, they're about a foot and a half by 2 feet.
About, yeah.
About that. So it's, I want to say 20 centimeters, maybe 30 centimeters by 45 or 50.
Yeah, it would be about, yeah, about 50 centimeters.
But yeah, so it's somewhere in that ballpark. I don't know exactly. I'm just going by what they look like.
Yeah, just trying to figure
it out. It's kind of like the size, you know, like how this here is like the A4 size of paper. It's kind of like an A3.
Yeah, it'd be a little bit longer, not by much.
And a little bit taller here, kind of like that. So, anyway, right before planting, or after they soak the seeds and whatnot, and the roots start to show, they put these in these plats, or these plaques with a little dirt.
So, now, do they just throw them under willy-nilly?
No,
or,
no.
So, there's a whole system to it. So, for me, planting, we have a whole assembly line, pretty much. It's a belt system, and on top of the belt, there's one place for dirt, one for the seeds, and for more dirt on top. And it would feed through, and the dirt would be put on, and the seeds would be placed evenly on top. Evenly is the key, and then put dirt on top and pat it down just a little bit.
Yep.
The reason that it has to be evenly put is because if it's clumped together, the machine that's used later won't be able to grab the seeds properly.
Yes.
Yeah.
And while planting, like just before we get into that, I have run into problems on the planter where there were clumps that were too closely put together.
Yes.
And the machine, like, literally have to get off the machine in the middle of the mud, separate them, or like fix the clump that's stuck, and then put it back. Go back a few feet and then plant again.
Well, let's leave that the fun mud troughs. That's fun. So okay, we put them in the trays, and then what do we do after? What do you guys do? Where do you put your trays after to germinate them to grow?
We normally, because it's usually cold out and there's the possibility of them freezing, they keep them in a greenhouse, and usually the greenhouse is kept warm.
Okay.
And by warm, I mean that it's at least above, I want to say above 10 degrees Celsius.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it sounds about the same as us. What we do is we put them all in the greenhouse. We cover them with a white tarp that's very thick, so it'll keep in the heat. And then no plastic, and then a white tarp on top, and we put rocks on it to keep it down. And we close all the vents and the front door, and we tie it and leave it there for about a week.
Yep.
And then we'll come and water it. But there's another way that I've seen it done as well that's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure if you've seen this, but they'll prepare a part of a rice paddy before.
Yep.
And they'll flood it. Mm-hmm. And they'll put all of the trays out and then put plastic lining on top and leave it like that.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
so all the moisture, so you don't have to water it. Just the moisture will come up from the ground.
Right.
So that's an interesting way to do it.
Right. So after the seedlings, if you want to put it that way, the seedlings reach to about, I don't know, 10 centimeters.
Yeah.
Around 4 inches.
Yeah, I'd say around 4 or 5 inches, yeah.
That is around the time that you're going to start planting.
Yes. The lovely planting time.
But before they go out into the field, usually what the farmers will do is they'll flood the paddies, and they'll make sure that the amount of water that's in the paddy is just above the level of the dirt.
And so what they'll do is, before they do that, the year before, you collect all the plants, and the stalks are left in the ground.
Mm-hmm.
So to take care of the stalks, what a lot of farmers will do, my father-in-law included, he'll burn the field.
Yep,
you burn the field. So for the first couple weeks in August, maybe, no, May or June, it's nothing but smoky atmosphere everywhere because everyone's burning their fields.
Right.
And the reason they do that is to take care of the stalks and to put the vitamins and the minerals and everything from the stalks back in.
Right. But the other thing is that another reason why they want to burn the fields like this is because if they want to plant rice again in the same field, if they just plow under the stalks, it will not do well for crop rotation, which is the reason why they burn the fields and then till it under afterwards.
Yeah, so then after they till it, then they'll flood it, just like you said, and till it up again until it's, until all the stalks have been removed, until the mud is nice and smooth.
Well, let's talk about how they flood the rice paddies.
Okay. So Japan has, how do I say this? They've irrigated pretty much the whole nation of Japan.
Yes.
The whole island of Japan. And that means that you have running water whenever you need it to the fields. And they use an intricate system of pulleys and levers and dams to get the water to move to where you want it.
Right. But there are, there's like three main ways that I've seen how they pump water into different locations. Like my wife's relatives, they live on top of a mountain. Trying to pump water up the mountain is very difficult.
So what do they do?
So some of the times they actually have a pump that goes down to a, like a dam that's at the top of a mountain. So in Japan, especially like in Akita, even Miyagi and Yamagata, when you get up into certain mountain ranges where there's like a valley in between mountains, they will put a dam up there and they'll have a huge reservoir of water sitting up there. And a lot of times there's pumps that go directly down into the dams there, and they pump up to cisterns up at the top of other mountains. So to pump the water up to a giant cistern. And then once it's up in that giant cistern, they go down to the fields and they turn like a crank to a hose, and the water from that cistern will flood. But when they close it back up, they can also have the water pump from that dam back all the way up there.
Okay.
Now, there's other places where they take rivers and they pump directly from the river instead, from the mountain runoff.
That is what we do in my home.
Right.
The river runs where I live. It was actually a river before, and we dammed off the river.
Mm-hmm.
They changed the actual course of the river.
Yep.
And now we just use the natural course of the river to pump into our fields when we need it.
And it's a gravity pump, so there's actually, they don't actually have to pump it like with a machine. The actual gravity and force of the river itself is enough force to push that water into the rice paddy itself.
Yep. So very convenient.
Yes. So there are a couple cisterns that they use up on mountains like that. It depends on how high up you are. Mm. Sometimes there's natural running rivers that come down there, but from where the relatives are, I'm pretty sure that they get it from a cistern.
Okay. So before we get into planting, I wanted to talk to you about the fertilizer that you use. So what kind of fertilizer do you guys use in the fields? Have you seen that it's been used in the fields?
Oh.
Or in on the plants?
On the...
Do you use modern fertilizer, or do you use anything else?
You know what? I am not exactly sure which fertilizer my uncle uses.
Do you know what they used to use right after World War II?
What?
Human waste.
Really?
Yeah, they would use human waste just straight into the fields.
Wow.
Oh, yeah. So just an interesting little fact for
and
you guys.
And just so you know, when it comes to using human waste when farming, is that usually at a sewage treatment plant, human waste has to stew, for lack of a better term, for about 10 years until the bacteria and enzymes break down enough so that when it goes to human consumption, you can actually eat the product from that human feces.
Yeah, which raises a lot of questions if all that was actually treated after the World War II.
Exactly.
Oof. But yeah, they used to use human waste or cow manure.
Yep.
Or the main fertilizer.
I'm pretty sure like most Japanese people now actually have a what is it like? It's created in a lab and they put it out on.
Yeah, most of it is modern chemical fertilizer.
Yeah.
But way back in the days.
Yeah.
That's what they used to use.
Yep.
So okay, so then we have all the seedlings, they've popped out, the field's taken care of. So what's the next step?
Well, once you dump the water in the field, you have to take what looks like, it's a tiller, but it looks like a lawnmower in the middle of the water on a tractor, and you just scoot around and try to even out the field with it.
Yep. Yeah, that is the weirdest thing to see, because it doesn't look like it's doing anything until they pull it up and then you see all the paddles going underneath.
Right. I mean, quite literally, it looks like somebody's pulling a lawnmower behind a tractor in the middle of a dirt-mud-filled rice field.
Although there is something oddly poetic or very calming about it, especially like at sundown when the sun's coming right on it, and it just looks so peaceful.
Right. Now, another thing is that
let's get into the poetry of rice planting.
Another thing is that, like, while they have larger size small tractors that they use in the fields, because you obviously can't use a giant 4x4 inside one of those fields there. Like, the 4x4 would probably be about a quarter of the size of the field, of the average field.
Of the average field, if you have a larger professional field, maybe you can use those. But yeah,
right.
Most of them are smaller.
Most of them are smaller because there's a lot of hairpin turns you have to take on there. But one of the things that you will see is with these tractors is where the wheels go in, they'll have these metal like sub wheel, like it's a metal sub wheel that they have attached to the main rubber wheel that sticks out about another 20 or 30 centimeters.
A good way to describe it is if you think of the Mississippi River and the old steamboats and the paddles on the back, the big
paddle boats.
Yeah, there you go, paddle boats. It looks exactly like the paddles, and they stick onto the back wheels of the tractor.
Right, and what that is there for is to help to make sure that the rubber wheels actually get grip when they're going through the mud.
Mm.
The other thing is to help it in case there's an area that is, let's just say, not as saturated with water compared to another one, so that if the tractor starts to tip a little bit, that metal guide, if you want to put it that way, that paddle boat guide, will possibly catch an area a little bit better.
Yeah, that is an interesting thing that happens within the fields. The bedrock, if you will, the bottom part, it's not even, no matter how many times you really till it up.
Yeah,
you will have low parts, especially after the big earthquake.
Yeah.
Before the big earthquake, our fields were pretty much perfectly straight.
Yep.
But now when you do them, there's parts where you just go, you lean down to the right or to the left.
Right. And I mean, and with a lot of different farmers here right after the earthquake, some of them had areas of their land like shift slightly.
Yeah.
And what they had to do is they had to go back and rezone it, because in between each field is kind of like, it looks like a walking path, but it's like a mini levee or a mini dike
that they
put in between the fields. And when the earth shifted a little bit, the dikes shifted as well. So they had to kind of rezone the land in between there. And there were areas where like it was a little higher or a little lower, but they had to re-level the land by correcting where the dikes should go.
Yep. Yeah, and that's an interesting process to watch as well.
Yeah. No, have you seen the machine that they use for that to like actually like pull the dirt up and push it up again?
It's a weird machine. I've never seen anything like it.
Yeah, it's kind of, it reminds me a lot of a trencher, but it's a trencher that's designed to pull earth up instead of take earth out.
Yeah, it's how do I explain it? It's kind of a silver wheel that's kind of, yeah, it's a silver wheel that rotates and pushes everything up.
Yep.
It's really interesting to see.
But it's also extremely heavy, so it pushes the earth down, so it's actually matted down so it doesn't wash away.
Yeah, so when you walk on it, it doesn't give at all.
Yeah.
Well, unless it's old, and then you'll fall into the field.
Yeah. And depending on the kind of soil that they put on there, if it gets too saturated with water, sometimes those little levees will break. And you'll see guys out there with giant, like, metal sheets or rock sheets trying to block the levee from actually breaking into another field. Because especially right after you've planted, if you have a break inside those levees or those mini levees or mini dikes, and it floods the field too much, then the rice may die from being stuck under the water. Because the mud can be really murky.
Yeah. Let's see, I think it is, if you submerge a plant for 24 hours, if it's underwater more than 24 hours, completely underwater, it will die.
Yeah.
So if you have like a quarter of it out of the water, it's fine. But anything more than that for 24 hours, it'll die. That's why it's very important.
And a lot of times after people have planted, you will see farmers go out to the field, and they will check the rows like almost every like 6 hours.
Oh yeah.
And they will go and they'll run the drain.
Or, yeah.
The drain to make sure they got the exact amount that they need inside the field. Like it's like right outside my house. I have rice fields and people that plant rice right outside my house.
So. Yeah. And one thing we should probably talk about is after 3/11, the big earthquake, how the government resized some of the rice fields and
yeah.
the laws about that. So I know that my family we were kind of affected by that.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of families were. The larger fields, a lot of the government made a mandate where you can only have a certain amount of fields
mm-hmm.
or a certain amount of rice within the fields now.
Yeah.
I'm not exactly sure the law 100%, but I know that a lot of our fields were cut in half because of those laws.
Well, I know like some of the fields were cut in half, but another thing that they also mandated as well was after the earthquake and tsunami, a lot of the main farmland that was along the coast all the way up from Kasenema all the way down to like Fukushima, a lot of that land was destroyed when the tsunami came in and dumped sand
mm-hmm.
all
yeah.
into that farmland. And even to this day, that farmland isn't used, or it's being repurposed as for like solar farms.
Yeah,
instead.
I think it was what? It'll be 10 years before any of it's usable for farmland.
Yeah. Well,
something like that.
But here's the thing. That's at a certain distance.
Okay.
Like the closer it is to the coast, the higher the sand content in the dirt is.
Right.
And the higher the sand content in the dirt is, the less likely you are able to grow rice.
Yep.
So
yeah.
at some of the land is like completely unusable for growing rice.
Yep.
But other parts of the land have been basically salted, which means that they'll take like 10 to 15 years to come back.
Yeah.
Depending on how much salt actually got into that land there.
Yeah, that's too bad.
It is very bad. So anyway, we're going to take a short break and come right back.
Okay.
Hi, we're back with the 14 podcast talking about farming.
Okay, so we talked about a little bit about getting the seeds ready and planting and getting the seedlings in their trays. And then we talked about getting the fields ready. Now it's time to move on to actually planting the rice.
Which, there's a fun job and a not so fun job.
So let's go into the history of planting it before we get into the
fun job and the not so
yeah.
fun job.
So how they did it before, it was actually used to be a big community job.
Yep.
It would actually start. It would start in May and go all the way till August, I think, because
yep.
it would take so long. And so the whole community would grow the rice, and then all the community would go to. They would block off they would flood the fields, get them ready, and then they would block them off with a grid of some sort.
Mm-hmm.
Or just people would be really good at focusing where they are. And they would take the rice and with their hand and take a little bit and pop it in the mud.
Yep.
And like I said, it would take forever to do. My father-in-law, the community where we live is very poor.
Mm-hmm.
And after World War II, they had nothing. So their main source of food was rice and,
right.
well, birds that they caught. And so they would take 3 months to plant all the rice.
Yep. And then the harvesting season, what's really nice and bad about it at the same time is that the planting season goes for 3 months, and then the harvesting season also goes for the same
mm-hmm.
3 months because of the germination period. Of those rice plant, the rice plant itself.
Yeah, so it was a long process in the old days. It's still a long process now, but not as much. And talking about the harvesting in the old days and the planting in the old days, you would have to bend over and plant all the rice by yourself.
Mm-hmm.
And looking at the older generation, you'll notice a lot of the older men and older women are hunched over.
Especially in the Tohoku area.
Yeah, for that exact reason, because they were always bent over doing their
There was
rice.
Another reason that someone told me, and this is not confirmed, so, but from what people had told me is like during World War II and even after World War II, there was this whole thing about drinking milk. in Japan, where they thought that that was a Western thing.
Really?
Right. And it's not that it was shunned, it was just that the propaganda, the kind of mindset was, well, we're Japanese, we're not going to do things the way the West does, with that mindset during that time period, which is not the same mindset now, but during that time period, they said that there was a lot of, due to the like lack of nutrition at certain ages for certain people, and due to the lack of like calcium, that people, the access to calcium that people had, was one of the main reasons why even today with our older generation, you see a lot more people with a hunched back.
There you go.
A lot of it could be having to do with like sitting on the floor at the same time too.
Well, yeah, there you go.
Yep.
Yep. Okay, so that was then, but how's it done now? So how do you plant, how do you get your plants from the trays onto the machine?
Well, my in-laws have a K-truck.
Okay.
Okay, and what a K-truck is, it's a 660cc engine pickup truck that it's kind of like a mid-sized motorcycle with four wheels and a cab.
It looks like a toy.
Yeah.
I'm going to be honest. It looks like a toy.
They put these racks on them that's usually about five or six high, and you put the little trays, the ones that we talked about before, inside there on these racks, and then they drive to the location, and you pull the racks off as you need them.
And each one of these racks, the whole rack in the back of the truck holds probably close to 100 to 200 of the trays, if not more, depending on the size of the truck.
Right. So it's usually about six or seven on each side. Like one row is about six or seven on each side, and then it's about five or six high.
Right. You're better at math than I am, so that's...
So six times seven is, what is 42? 42 times two, it's
84. So about 100.
It's about 100.
Yeah.
So, and I didn't actually count the exact amount, so we're going to say about 100.
Yeah. And you can also stack them, you know, other ways as well. I've seen them stacked diagonally as well to make more room. So generally in the trike, you can fit about 100 of the trays. Yep. And so then you drive out to the field, and it's usually a whole family affair. There's everyone there, people to take out the trays, people to prepare the rice, and people to clean, and probably one or two drivers.
Now, one of the funny things about the trays is that the roots from the seedlings are usually stuck to the bottom of the tray. So if you try and just kind of try and put the slab that they use to put underneath it, if you try and just shove that in there, you might cut a lot of the roots off.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do, and this is actually kind of interesting, is they roll the thing back, the dirt from the seedlings back, and it almost looks like they're rolling up carpet.
Yeah, it's really cool.
And then they put it back, and then after they've rolled it so that they've pulled the seedlings lightly from the bottom, then they put this slat underneath it and scoop all of it up and pull it out in one go.
For a visual, for people who don't know what we're talking about, think of laying sod and put the sod inside a tray, and then when you pull up the sod, that's kind of the same visual.
Yeah.
And then all you do is you put a slat underneath, a metal sheet or plastic sheet, to take it out of the tray.
Yep. And the reason for the slat is the planter itself usually consists of from four, and then there's six, and there's also eight.
There are,
depending on the size of the field that you're planting in. If you're planting in a small field, you want to use a four. Mm-hmm. But if you're planting a mid-size six, and if you're planting in a really large field, most people use an eight.
Yeah. And what we're talking about is the rows of when you take the trays out, you put them in the back of the machine.
The back of the machine. Okay, and I'm gonna try and give you a visual here. It's like you have slats here, like one, two, three, four, like this. Okay, and it's a line. They're divided in a line, and they go all the way down to the ground, basically, where the machine's going to pull a piece, pull a piece, pull a piece, pull a piece, and plant it. Now, what you want to do is you want to put these slats in here. So you put one, two, three, usually about three or four high, inside each four of these rows, and that's what the planter uses to pull.
Now, on the bottom of the planter, there are little things that look like hooks, kind of like two fingers or three fingers. And what they'll do is they'll rotate back and forth. One comes up while the other one goes down.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll do the same thing as the community would. They would take the little chunk of the seedlings and pop them into the ground. And they would just rotate back and forth during that.
So, but this thing, obviously, like we were saying here with the four rows that we had showed over here, what they would do is they would plant all four of those at the same time. Instead of it being one person taking, this thing would basically do four rows at five times the speed.
So instead of five fields taking 3 months, it takes
five fields would probably take 2.5 hours, maybe 3 hours.
If you have a fast machine, yeah.
Yeah. If you have a fast machine, you know what you're doing. And
oh,
you can, and like, if you're like a 70-year-old guy that's been doing this for years, man, you're probably done with that in an hour and a half.
Now, if you're like me and your machine is older than dust, you'll get done with six fields in about 6 hours, seven hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. But that's about the right pace.
Yep.
If you go too fast, then you can end up messing up the machine or not planting the rice where it's supposed
right.
to go.
Right. Like we were talking about before, if you don't evenly place those seeds on the slats themselves, you'll get these giant clumps. And then comes basically the part that really sucks.
So the part that really sucks is getting into the field, because when you're planting, most of the water has been drained, so it's just a muddy mess. And when you get into the field, it's about knee-high deep mud.
Right, and you're wearing boots that basically go right up to your knees. Like the boots that I have, when I actually had to get off the planter in the middle of the field to walk around to undo a clump, it went up, I want to say, almost 40 centimeters. And I was talking with my wife's relatives, and they're saying, next time just ask one of us to go do it. Because you're very big, and you'll probably sink in.
Yeah.
So they're like, and the other thing is that the what the elderly people tell you to do is when you go and you step in the mud is to do heel toe.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Heel toe. If you do toe heel, you may not get your boot out.
Oh yeah, there's been multiple times when I'm in the field and you know we get. Some of the rows don't get planted or there's a clump and you have to get out. And if you just jump in, your boots staying in there.
Yeah.
It's a fight to get it out.
Right. Right. So every now and then when the planter goes back and forth, you run the lines back and forth and you finally get the field done. There's always going to be a small section that didn't get planted correctly. I mean, there's no getting around it. So usually what happens is once you finish planting that section, usually someone who is older will go back out there, bend over, and then plant the section that you missed.
Yeah,
that was just kind of a miss by the machine itself.
Yeah, when you're taking the corner, when you're turning around or taking the corners, you're bound to miss something. So someone will always go in and plant by hand
right.
a little bit.
But it's because you're using that planter. The amount of stuff they actually have to plant by hand usually isn't all that much.
Yep.
Usually it's right where you enter the field is where they have to hand plant. And usually right, during like hairpin corners or like oblong shaped fields that have sections that may be a little bit weird.
Yeah, where it's hard to get in with the machine.
Yeah, because not all fields here are like the square patties that you're used to seeing.
Yeah, no. There's a lot of fields that are triangle shaped or kind of circular shaped on one side, straight down the other.
And there are certain ones that you could definitely call a polygon.
Yeah, there's a lot of different ones. It's interesting to see.
Right.
Maybe if we get a drone, we can go over sometime.
Yeah.
So then plant the seeds. You plant the plants and. You cover them up in the field.
And then at that point, all you do is regulate water.
That's all you do. Well, regulate water, spray pesticide for bugs if you do that.
Well, a lot of the farmers and whatnot, they don't really spray like overhead like like you would with like a machine or whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of them have the BT.
Oh yeah.
The BT, the inoculation that all of the plants get.
Right.
That what is it? Pretty much all rice in Japan is all GMO.
So. Right. Yeah. Well, yeah.
Anyway, there's a specific bacteria or whatnot that they put in the plant itself that keeps the bugs away. That also assists as instead of a herbicide and a pesticide.
Hmm. Now, if they do pesticides, a lot of what the people will do, especially in more rural areas, they will do crop dusting.
Yeah.
Or they will have like my father-in-law. He has a backpack full of pesticide and just crop dusts everything by hand. That's done in more rural areas.
Yeah, like this, we're talking about areas that are like nowhere near a town or nowhere near like drinking water supplies.
Yeah, if you did this during close to any drinking water or any towns, it would be a disaster.
Yeah, so like for me, where I live in the town I live in and the fields right outside my house, they normally don't spray for pesticides out there.
Yeah, and where I live, there's literally no one. There's tanuki only. So yeah. It's not that bad.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Yep. So just regulate the water.
And then come September, September and for the late rice, October, November, is harvesting.
Yep. So harvesting before you start to harvest is when you start to drain out the water.
Yes.
So around this time of year, it's around August, is when when the plants have reached almost maturity.
Mm-hmm.
You can see the yellow coming out on the top of the stalks.
Mm-hmm.
That's the rice really coming out and being mature. This is when they start to take out the water and drain everything.
Right.
And what that'll do is it'll essentially kill the plant.
Right.
And dry it out so you don't have to do it too much.
What they're trying to do is they're trying to pick a specific point in the germination cycle of the plant so that the rice plant itself will still hold the rice inside of it, so it's not at a certain point of maturity that the rice will fall out.
Yeah, and it'll seed. Yeah. So, they will drain the field, and that's once the plant turns yellow or brown is when they harvest the rice.
Yep. And before they actually take a combine out and take the rice out of the field, usually they go in with a sickle or a scythe, and they will cut out a section at the very entrance from which the combine enters so that the combine can have a smooth entrance and they don't destroy the rice as it's trying to enter the field.
Mm. And then so after they do that, it's time to harvest.
Yes.
And so the way they harvest is they use a combine, but it's not the combine that you think of when harvesting corn or some other crops with a large wheel on the front.
Right.
It's just a combine with either one, if it's a small combine, it'll have one slot or up to four slots I've seen before.
And the other thing is that, like, the way it looks is very different from, like, the Western style of combine. It kind of looks like a Zamboni.
Yeah, it does.
Right.
It really does.
It's square in shape. So it's very, like, boxy, square in shape. And it really does look like a Zamboni.
It's amazing, yeah. The first time I did see people harvesting, I really thought that's what it was, 100%.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so what they'll do is they'll take it, once it gets full with the grain, they'll either have people with a truck or they'll have bags on a crane that they'll fill up when they're finished with the field.
Yep, and usually they have these huge, giant bags that they put on the back of those K-trucks, and like that K-truck is weighted down. Like,
it probably weighs more than the K-truck, to be honest.
Yeah, I mean, that K-truck turns into a lowrider real quick. So what they do at the end of the season is they take the rice that they had harvested and they separate it into three piles. The first pile is going to be the pile that they're going to use to replant the next year. The second pile is what they're going to use for their own personal use throughout the year. And the third pile is what they're actually going to sell. So an interesting thing about this is that the rice that they sell has not been husked yet. So when it goes to the elevator, they normally husk it there at the elevator and then store it.
And what is, for people who don't know, what is the elevator?
An elevator is like a grain storage system. So usually there is, anywhere in Japan that you go to, there's going to be a large elevator for a giant, or for the community that everybody takes their rice to or takes their soybeans to. So what's, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, and then there's also for, the elevators are more for the community use for storage, and then there's also for personal use, the smaller ones that you can find for right. 100 yen or 150 yen on the sides of roads to do small quantities of rice for right. personal use.
Right. Oh, yeah. I was just about to get into that.
Yeah.
So the elevator is not necessarily the government, but a company's rice that they buy from the farmers, and that's where they store it from after buying it from the farmers. So usually that's the giant elevator. Now there's like your coin rice washing stations, which are almost unheard of in pretty much any place that does not like regularly produce rice. So if you're like in Tokyo, or if you're like in like Chiba, Ibaraki, Ginza, Shibuya,
yeah, probably the bigger places,
you probably won't see any of these anywhere. But when you're out in the sticks,
like us,
you're going to see these stations where you take that unhusked rice and they take it for you and you run it through a machine where it husks all the rice and then spits it back out. You still have to wash it, but it husks all the rice that you had harvested from your field.
Yeah, so what it'll do is you just go in there. It looks kind of like a coin laundry or a payphone kind of, but larger. And you go in there and you take your rice and you can pay a certain amount for how much rice you want to do and dump it into one section. And that will take all the rice and it'll spin it through a centrifuge and it'll beat the rice until all the husks come off. And then you put your bag underneath the other side and it'll come out without the husks on. And then you can take it home and you can wash the rice in your rice cooker and cook it from there for personal use.
Right. Now, we're going to talk about like personal farming as well for like your own home gardens and whatnot. So usually most farmers that have giant plots of land also have their own personal farms on site as well. Now, usually they don't take up a lot of space, but that's where they normally grow their tomatoes, eggplant, cucumbers. What is Goya? Goya in English.
Goya, oh man. Goya, I couldn't tell
you. It's a bumpy pickle.
I believe it's a species of cucumber, and it's just a very acidic, very bitter tasting kind of cucumber.
Yeah, it's a bumpy pickle.
Yeah. So yeah, this is, a lot of farmers do just personal subsistence farming. I think we both do it as well.
Yeah.
So a lot of farmers, the main crops that I always see people grow are edamame, soybeans, they do tomatoes,
cucumbers,
of course, nasu, eggplants.
Yeah. And tomatoes.
Oh yeah. A lot of tomatoes.
Yep.
A lot of Japanese people love tomatoes.
Yep. And usually, depending on the size of the garden, they'll dedicate an entire section to pumpkin.
There is a lot of pumpkin, and a lot of, Suica, watermelons as well.
Yep. And more often than not, you don't see a lot of the round onions, like your
normal white tabanegi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You normally see leeks.
Yeah, the giant, really long white onions.
Yeah, well, yeah, they're leeks.
Yeah. Yeah.
But usually, like, a lot of times, like in the States, when I bought leeks, they were like, really, really small
yeah.
and short. These ones are thick.
Yeah, you could, you could beat someone with these. I mean, they're so big.
Right.
Don't beat anyone, but I'm just saying.
Now, yeah. One thing I will say about how they plant here is the soil here in Japan is so soft. Like, it is, I don't know how to describe it. I'm used to, like, dirt that is, like, really, really hard that, like, it's a lot of actually work to dig into the ground.
Yeah,
to,
you
like,
need a pickaxe.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yeah.
To dig out some of, like, the earth. But here, it is, like, I don't want to say silty, but it's kind of, like, it's definitely high-quality soil, but it's almost silty.
Yeah, it's very nutrient-rich, and you can literally, like, just scoop it with your hand.
Right. Like,
for the most part.
Like, without worrying about, like, you know, injuring your fingernails or anything like that.
So much.
It's almost as if you had a manicure, you could take and dig down in there without worrying about wrecking it.
Well, you know, it's good for your nails and all. So, it is very good quality dirt, and a lot of people also do composting as well.
Yep.
The only thing with composting, if you use a composter, the enclosed systems, they are a breeding ground for snakes. And
yes.
So a lot of people don't like to use them.
Yes.
What you'll see is a lot of open compost piles, which are just compost piles with a blue sheet tossed over them.
Yep.
And then they'll take it off every once in a while and flip it around.
Yep.
But even that has a lot of snakes. But.
Like we were saying in another podcast, there's this Yamakagashi that is a snake that's native to this area, especially near mountain ranges and whatnot. And it's kind of a brownish-orange snake with a yellow ring on its neck, and it's actually poisonous.
And they're nasty, nasty little snakes.
Yes, yes.
So that's why a lot of people choose to do open composting. So there's not an enclosed box that you have to worry about.
Right. So another thing I was going to say about the soil is that the planting process in Japan, when you're doing, like, planting a garden, is a lot different than what I was used to in the West. So usually when we planted stuff, what we would do is we'd go out in the field after it's been tilled and after it's been, like, spaded and when it's been worked over to a point that it's been cultivated to a point that it's good for planting, you would dig a hole, put the plant inside, and then cover up the roots with the hole and then pour water on it for, like, when you're, like, planting tomatoes.
Right.
Well, in Japan, you plant it at regular, like, right on top of the dirt, and then they push the dirt up on top of it,
mm-hmm.
and they make, like, these giant rows that look like, I don't know
they're,
how to...
They're long anthills, pretty much.
Yes.
They're just long rows of a pyramid, pretty much, a long pyramid.
Yeah, and it's usually flat right across the top.
Yeah, they pat it down on the top with a spade or something.
Yep.
And just put the seeds right on top and right inside of me.
And it's the best way that they can do it with the soil that they have, because the soil that they have is actually going to flatten out over time. But when they first do it, it looks kind of strange.
It does, yeah.
It looks like they're planting above the soil.
Yeah. And another thing that a lot of people do as well, especially the weekend farmers like me, they use black plastic,
mm-hmm.
that you'll see a lot. So you build up the pile the same, and then you just put black plastic around it, and it'll eventually flatten out as well.
Yep. It basically keeps the weeds out and makes it a lot easier so that the weeds aren't pulling all the nutrients out around the whatever you're growing. But it also makes it easier to weed around the plants itself.
Yeah, it's a nice little system. If you live out in the middle of nowhere, like
right.
we do. But when you live out in the city, it's a little bit of a different story. So living out in places like Tokyo or Chiba or any of those places, it's kind of hard to do gardening. So people have learned or taken measures to be able to grow their own food.
Yeah, they'd use what's like what I'd call like a commune garden or a community garden. And what it is like, let's say that someone took like a giant rice field or like three or four rice fields and they put them all together in one, and then they boxed them off into small boxes so that people could rent a box of land to plant a garden.
And a lot of places do this in larger cities. There's either, you'll see either apartment buildings where there's a playground and a little plot laid out for everyone to use, Or in this big city, you can reserve a spot outside the city a little bit where you can go on the weekends and take care of your plants.
And even like, what is it? They use those community gardens or those commune gardens in Taiwan. I've seen them in Taiwan, where they have, you have skyscraper, 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 small building, garden, community garden, small building, skyscraper, skyscraper, skyscraper.
There you go. Yeah, everyone needs a little bit of their
Yep.
homegrown goodness. And another thing that a lot of Japanese people do as well is use the boxed gardens or the rooftop gardens
Yep.
as well, for people who don't have space to go to communal gardens that are too far away. They can use the boxed
And
gardens.
Japan is really isn't big about having the boxes that hang over the balcony. That's definitely a no-no in Japan.
Yeah, the reason obviously is because of earthquakes.
Yeah. And if you are on like the 16th story and you have one of those box gardens and there's an earthquake
Yep.
and it falls, hopefully it doesn't hit something or someone.
Yeah. I remember when I moved to Japan for the first time, I was living alone and I wanted to have a garden. So I live in an apartment with a veranda and I was on the first floor. So I was able to have my own little garden. I had to build a shelf and make sure that it was attached to the ceiling, that it was held down with rods that so if an earthquake did come, it wouldn't shake so much and fall over. So even if you live on the first floor and you have a shelving, you will have a measures that you will have to take to in order to have that garden. And even that is rare
Yeah.
on the first floor.
Yep. Well, I think that's all we got for today.
You know, I think my green thumb has turned into a brown thumb. I think you're right.
Okay.
All
We'll talk to you later.
righty, bye.
Bye-bye.